Red Ice Radio. Welcome and thank you for tuning in today, ladies and gentlemen. RedIce.tv is the website where you can hear the radio show and watch our videos and the TV show. We're also expanding with new segments and additional shows, so make sure you keep an eye on the website. Also, make sure that you subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's where a lot, but not all, but you know, most of our content go up on the YouTube channel. We have an exclusive website for our subscribers as well, RedIceMembers.com. Where everything we do is available, and that's how we keep this going. That's how we can keep the websites, the shows, and the videos, and all that good stuff ad-free, free from globalist commercials pushing SJWs and feminist messages on you. So definitely support us if you like what we do. The radio show you can also hear on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, and we also have an RSS feed. You can either hook up iTunes or whatever podcast app that you do prefer. So easy, as always, to tune into the show. Well, our guest today is Isaac Bouman. He's the author of Money Power, A Force for Freedom or Slavery. It's good to have you on the show, Isaac. Thank you for coming on.
And thank you, Henrik, for having me. It's really good to be here.
Excellent. Now, I know a little bit about you. I know that you have background working at a bank on Åland. That's, for those who don't know, an island that's between Sweden and Finland. It's kind of a it's not quite like a microstate, I think, but they do have some legal framework that's unique to the island. But tell us about your interest in the topic of economics, if that solely comes from your bank work, or how did you get into that?
It is a longer story. I could start further back, but we can just start by saying that I wrote this book, which from the beginning was my master's thesis at Åbo Akademi University, which is the Swedish university in Finland. There is a quite significant minority of Swedes in Finland, including the Ålanders, and that has this autonomous government there. But many Swedes study at this university. And there was a somewhat open academic environment there. So I took the opportunity to explore this topic while I was also working at this bank. I had two different positions there. First one was working with capital markets, as you call it, selling papers of various forms like government bonds and things like that, mm-hmm. the stock exchange. So it gave some valuable insight. And I also worked at another position with the very payment systems of the bank itself. So it really was a good environment to study the current monetary system. It is a small bank, the Bank of Åland, but it still operates with the same principles as do the big banks. So I really took the chance and put it all together in the book. We might go further back also in my background, but maybe there will be opportunities to take that up also further in the interview. So,
yeah, definitely. I mean, it's tell us a bit about kind of the objective when you were writing the book. What was at the root of your desire to share the information? What did you feel was most important to get out?
Well, one thing I noted when I started my studies at Åbo Akademi Economics was that there was one thing missing. I didn't note it immediately, but as I had an interest for, say, alternative media for various reasons, I surfed around the web and was very interested in looking at various documentaries and things that covered this topic of the banking and monetary system. But I think I thought that they were lacking this broad picture that, for example, one example that many listeners might know, just as a pedagogical example, the Zeitgeist documentaries, they have a somewhat, they have their valid points, I think, in the analysis of the current system, but the end conclusion that they come to there is that the economic system and the monetary system is corrupt, so yeah, let's replace it with this Venus project, a global centralized computer that would take care of everything. And I wasn't satisfied with what was out there, what I was searching for. I was also searching for more profound philosophical, theoretical perspective of what money is and also alternatives to the system. I thought that was very lacking. So I want to make a contribution here with Money Power so that no one else need to go through the same effort to surf around and read around on the various glimpses and pieces that are out there.
Yeah, consolidating the data and material is always a good idea. We need that. People don't have the time, sometimes even the interest to look into everything. But if they can get it, kind of condensed in one volume, it's much easier for them to go through that. But so the book is published by Arctos. Tell us about that. Did they pick you? Did you pick them? Or how come you published with them?
It was a little bit of both. I realized, of course, when you get this overview of the current financial structures and the money power of today, you realize that their influence is quite vast. They don't own every publishing company in the world, of course, but it is a power that you need to take into consideration, especially when choosing a publishing house. So I was looking for a publishing house that would be not be susceptible to pressure if there would be controversy around the book, because it really exposes the current system as it is. And Arctos, I thought, could do a good job of that. And besides, Arctos also gave the best chances to publish it in English, of course, which otherwise I wouldn't be here today, probably. So that's was also an important aspect. And then I could add, of course, that once I saw the money power of today and corporate media paid for politicians and how it all functions together, I, of course, started thinking about what kind of movements or what kind of people would have a chance to achieve reform. And after I had studied the European New Right and things like that, I haven't really found something that is more coherent, something that has the potential to evolve into something that can transform the culture, including the monolithic monetary culture that we are living in today. So in that sense, it was very logical that I chose Arctos.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Publishing is actually very limited to that extent in Sweden. Very few owners of the book publishing companies and stuff like that. Very few families, but so you kind of mentioned this a little bit already, but so were you kind of ideologically aligned with some of the other topics that they publish on? I mean, it obviously could be interesting to hear a bit more about your political ideologies and if you've been interested in or sympathetic to a more anti-globalist stance or even a pro-nationalist stance.
To answer that that question properly, I would like to go quite far back into my childhood, because it has been a very long and bumpy road. And to give a context of where I come from, I first memory I've had of taking interest in social issues was really in early childhood, when I got a Christmas present from my grandmother when I was 8 years old. It was a book about the rainforest, and it also took up this deforestation issue. And I was really bothered about this thing that all this life, nature was really disappearing from our earth, and I was very concerned about this, and eventually made a sincere promise, even though I was very young at the time, but I made a sincere promise that I would make my part in order to protect life on earth, basically. That was how I did as a child. It was a promise to myself that I think planted some kind of subconscious seed, at least, that set me on some sort of path. And this was further enforced at the age of 13 when the events of 9/11 happened. And as many others, I couldn't grasp the full picture, of course, at the time. But I thought it was really strange that the Bush regime at the time talked so much about protecting the free world and the freedoms of America and all peoples at the same time that they were implementing the surveillance state with the Patriot Act, for example. I couldn't grasp it, even though I was very young. I had serious questions about this, and I was further bothered and really disturbed by the way the adults and the media covered these topics, because there was basically three ways of looking at this topic. Like the media, for example, they didn't discuss it at all. That's one way. The second way I was met by was that it wasn't a concern unless you had anything to hide, if there was something suspicious about you. And so I thought I couldn't have any counter arguments at the time, but I thought it was somehow stupid. I was allergic to that argument, and also that this would never happen because we were the free world. That was something only for the communist party states, and and it would never happen. And I could see it happen. It was happening before my eyes as well as before there. So this made me lose faith in, we could say, mainstream media and also the general discourse quite early on. Mm-hmm. So I began thinking at a very early age outside the box. I was looking for answers. I wanted to understand the world. And a third thing that I'm very grateful for in hindsight was an initiative by the local government on Åland Islands when I was 15 years old. It was a so-called youth council, which was meant to be a council for the local government there on Åland Islands, because there was a really low interest among the youth for social issues at the time. It's probably low in general as well, but it was lower than usual. This council was meant to give the youth a voice, and I was elected chairman there. So not only did I sit in regular meetings with the government from the age of 15 and during my whole high school period, but I was also called by local media as soon as there was any topic covering the youth. And I, just to make it clear that this was before the time of identity politics, and the main impression I got of the political discussions at the time was it was all about economics, about how to achieve growth, how to create jobs, who would get benefits, who would not, and so on. So I made the conclusion that if I wanted to understand myself ideologically and politically, there were many parties that wanted me to join their ranks, obviously, and create some kind of youth group for them, but I couldn't choose. I didn't know if I was red, blue, or green, or whatever. So instead, I chose to study economics because I wanted to understand myself ideologically. And eventually, after a long and bumpy road with studies, I took the chance to study politics from inside a bit. I wasn't really seriously involved in any part. I saw it more like study chances for study. But I was active for a while in what's called the Swedish People's Party. And it is the party traditionally, historically, it's been the party promoting the interests of Swedes in Finland. I don't think they do a really good job, to be honest, but that's another topic of itself. And I've also been a party secretary for a local party, which is, I would say, at least Eurosceptical and somewhat politically incorrect to some extent. So, but more to study from inside. I also became active in the Green Movement for a while. I've worked for Agenda 21, actually, which is somewhat different on Åland Islands than the American version. But still, the discourse, I think, are similar. So
yeah.
That's also. But eventually, once I had finished Money Power, I came to the realization that this corporate power really is hostile to European interests. And I was, to some extent, something was activated at the time. I was provocated by it and sort of started to lean towards this more, what you want to call it, anti-globalist stances and so on, because that was really where I saw that a difference could be made.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you mentioned kind of a disconnect earlier, which I think is an important step to be able to start thinking for yourself. I don't know why it occurs with some people and not with others, but our culture and our narrative have become so homogenized that it's actually very few people that really manage to think outside of the box. And when they do, I think many of them, not all, of course, but many of them, they come to be sympathetic to the issues and the concerns that the people like us have, you know, in terms of the fact that we're seeing globalization is just ruining everything. It's basically turning everything into the same. It's basically have stopped having regard for the environment, for example. I mean, deep ecology is actually a big part of the European New Right. And now I'm not talking about kind of a global warming or, you know, climate change or anything like that. Those seems to be mechanisms that the globalists use to kind of chain countries to agreements that basically will prevent them from acting on a sovereign level. So to your point in terms of, you know, your background and how you started to sympathize with some of these issues and the anti-globalist stance, what was the local reactions like when you actually published the book?
I could first add here also as well that to this discussion about globalization, before I come to your question, is that globalization today by many is seen as some kind of natural force. And I don't agree with that. It is one of the contributions of the current economic system is that it is globalizing the world in a way that takes away national cultures. So to some extent, I mean, people have asked me if I'm a nationalist. And yeah, to some extent, I might be that. But I think a better term to describe this vision I prefer is really internationalist. I mean, the nationalist vision implemented on a global scale does not mean supremacy for one single nation. We can have collaboration, and furthermore, I think what globalism really means is it is counter to nature. It is counter to truth. It is exploitative both of nature and man. Yeah. So another term I like, which is also I've seen somewhere. I don't know who came up with the term organic humanism, but it is part of the. You're right to some extent. It is not like that I come up with the term, but I think that's a good term to describe a broader vision that this is really about living in harmony with nature and truth, and that is also contrary to the economic systems that we have, which is very deceptive to reason.
Yeah, let me interject there before we go to the question I asked earlier. But I agree with you because the way I see it is. Nationalism for everyone, right? Self-determination and sovereignty for all people, no matter where they are. It's actually, in that regard, I want an implementation of not equality, not enforced equality, but basically that we should be on equal terms, that we, among each other, should be able to decide what we want as our group or as our people or nation or what have you. But that's gone out the window completely. And now we're in a situation where all these things are forced on us. And we have no say in it, and that's you know the biggest objection that I have. But yeah, I guess if you want to switch over, unless you have any more comments to that, on the local reactions when you published the book.
The local reactions, because I to some extent had been a public person with my involvement in the Green Movement. I had also been a journalist at the local newspaper for a time, and I was to some extent a known person, so therefore it was, interesting for the news that some known person had chosen to publish a book with the extreme publishing house of Arctos. So that's how it started. I got some attention from the book. The book. Painted first Arctos as this very evil publishing house, and it sort of became my responsibility to answer for all questions and involvements that Arctos has had and things
that.
Like that. And this really escalated. One of the local newspapers did an interview where they came to the conclusion that the main or one difference between me and Hitler was that he promoted genocide and I promoted alternative monetary system. So I answered, of course, quite ironically that I was very grateful for them making this very true distinction, actually. So that's
pansies. It's always like this. These people are why is it they can't take anything that we say, like, with seriously, or like they think we're just kind of like lying because at the end we just want to mass murder people or something, you know? I don't get it. But anyway, do go on.
Yeah, and what was interesting though in this story was that there were two quite well-renowned professors of one of which is a very respected person on Åland Islands. He is not nationalist in any sense whatsoever, but he in my opinion he is one of the true. Honest academics that really exist out there. There are people like that. And he was a bit confused by this review. He thought it was quite extreme, the review. Mm-hmm. And and read the book himself to create his own opinion on it. And he, one of the things that were controversial in this review that was made was that I went through the economic recovery of Germany in the 30s. And this is really relevant from the perspective of monetary reform, because even among conventional economists, it is recognized that what happened in Germany before the Second World War regarding economic recovery is quite unique, and it happened during the Great Depression, and there have been speculations and reasons why it was that. So I took interest in this topic and explored first-hand sources. For example, the director of the Central Bank, both in the Weimar Republic and later in the Third Reich, Hjalmar Schacht, who wrote a book about this, and he explained that the reason they were able to achieve this was the implementation of so-called MEFO bills, which was really interesting way to infuse the economy with extra credit. And I further went to the explore the party platform at the time, which is quite relevant if you were discussing reforms, and also showed that even the highest leadership, Hitler himself, was aware of this aspect of the monetary politics. Mm. So I showed this, that this was a conscious effort, and just to emphasize how the potential in economic reform, and I mean, if you're very scared about Germany at that time, I mean, why should we allow that to be the only example for economic recovery? We should take the instead do it ourselves, like in a similar manner. This was also what these both professors really understood when they read the book, and they saw it in what context it was discussed, really. So what was interesting about this story was that even though this topic is so controversial and so sensitive, it really came to the conclusion that sort of the book won out. And I think many locals have now, I know many locals have read the book because of this coverage. So some in some way it was good that it happened, even though, I mean, you're only a human being. It's not, it can be quite stormy, even though it's a small place.
Yeah, I think you've struck something really interesting here, actually, because it goes to the heart of this issue of why many, not all, but many are so adamant about deterring people to stay away from this area of history, too. It's the association, of course. It's you're guilty per association. You're also not allowed to look objectively on this history itself, which I also find interesting. And I think, of course, many lower level people, they simply think, I think literally they think that at the end of the tunnel, if you start going on that route, that's going to lead to mass murder. So we can't do that. So the logical conclusion is to go in the complete opposite direction. But I do think that some of them, maybe even those who planted all these seeds or kind of began with the brainwashing of people, again, to deter them from even looking objectively at this, is because they know something happened where they monetarily threw off the shackles of the globalists, right? They managed to do something economically that made them very independent. They managed to regain self-control and build up their own country in an extraordinary amount of time, record time. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing, the recovery. And I've always felt, maybe it's because somewhere up the ladder, there's people who just, they don't want to see that happen again. Again, not because of the supposed mass murder at the end of all of this, but just for the fact that they don't want to have nations being sovereign and like performing as well as they can on themselves. We know that if you have a nation or even individuals that are downtrodden and dependent, and they're dependent on government, and they, you know, need to take loans or, you know, bank loans, you know, from the IMF and all this stuff, that's the situation that they want you in because you're controllable at that point, right? So that's, I mean, it's a bigger picture here that's painted, but that's ultimately why I feel some of the more higher-ups are deterring us from ever even just objectively trying to make an attempt at look at this stuff.
Sure, it's logically in that way. And what can be said also is that from my research, my judgment is that the reforms that were made there at the time were really just a part of what can be achieved. So there is much more potential. And yeah. Hjalmar Schacht himself said that the reason he had to go out was that he wouldn't go the whole way. He was quite, to some extent, aligned with he had a background on not on Wall Street, but in this financial sector at least. So I mean, in the modern era, there is even more potential. But we can maybe discuss that later on when we come to alternative.
Yeah.
Solutions more. That's maybe to go ahead of ourselves a bit.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good idea. So just to kind of spring on from this topic that we're on now, I just wanted to touch a little bit on further treatment, because what happens, of course, is that you're hounded by the media. Local media, as you said as well, are in many cases very willing to basically throw out everything you've ever said because of an association, right? So someone comes along and says, oh my God, he's publishing with Arctos. These are dangerous right-wing Nazi ideas. And everyone just falls in line in lockstep. We have an organization in Sweden called Expo that basically is a little sheepdog that's keeping the sheep in place and making sure that they don't run outside of the little perimeter that we're given of what's okay and not okay to discuss, right? This has happened to me, and it happened to you as well after you published the books. Tell us how what do they do to smear you and libel you and make untruths and exaggerations?
In all this media coverage locally, the main, when this smearing was going on, the source always was Expo. So as I know local media, I worked for local media myself on the island, I know how scarce the resources are with time and energy, so I really could see no possibility that they would do all this research themselves on Arctos, and they had explored various sources of used in the book and so on. It was really massive work, and in this smearing, Expo was quoted regularly of what this source and that source would be called and what Arctos is called and so on.
So they're lazy; they just want quick answers and someone else to tell them what to think about X.
Yeah,
right?
And they trust the authority. I don't know exactly how the communications lines have gone, but what at least can be observed is that newspapers, even though if they are independent in themselves, they are susceptible to the authorities of so-called of these really modern Stasi agencies. What Expo does. I mean, they archive different people and their views and opinions and take every chance they can to smear you.
I didn't think they like to be on lists, create lists. Yeah,
you might think so. Yeah, according to the rhetoric, but it's not to be true. And I mean, another interesting thing, just for listeners to know that Expo has been directly financed by. For example, George Soros, which is an interesting thing to view. I mean, like a big financial magnate like that. Why does he sponsor such initiatives? There is also reasons. He thinks it serves his interest because they are afraid of opposition coming from that way, so to speak.
They just want to. They have a dog in the fight. It's not about objectivity or truth or understanding people's concerns or qualms or anything like that. It's literally about smearing people as much as they can, so that surrounding people won't dare to listen to them. Right? That if we can make a character assassination so extreme as possible, it will basically, that will be an attempt to deter other people from listening to what they have to say and figure it out for themselves. Is this rational? Is this logical? Does it make sense? Are their concerns okay? Are they really hateful extremists that just want to kill people? Or what are they really about, right? But I think it's not going to serve them well at the end, because, you know, if people actually listen to what we say and actually try to understand the concerns that we have, I do think that normal, rational people will see some level of legitimacy in those concerns. And so they're almost like overstepping their boundaries, where they're like they lie and exaggerate so much that it at the end, if people care about the truth, it'll make them look bad. I don't know. What do you think? Mm.
I do think so, and I really saw what was the interesting experience from this story was that this actually did happen, and it did surprise me that this happened so early on. It might be, I don't know if it is a sign of a shift or something, but it did surprise me that sort of mainstream professors would do this and go to the resources. And in this case, the motivation was that the reviews were so extreme and exaggerated. So it really created a curiosity. Can it really be that bad? We'll see what happens. It seems like overplaying the cards a bit.
Yeah, and there's just a last note on this, but they're a pawn. They're a tool of globalism and these big, at this stage, big finance interests and who is aligned with leftists. We'll get to this a little bit later of how that alignment kind of happened. But frankly, they're doing it just to win politically. They have a dog in the fight. It's not about being objective. It's about they want to politically make sure that no one on our side of the fence gets any recognition, legitimacy, or even a fair play in the media and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, I mean, that's why much of the mainstream media in Sweden is tanking, frankly, and people are walking away from it because it just doesn't correspond with the reality anymore. But let's get into the heart, if you don't mind, a little bit of the book, obviously, in terms of the monetary structure and how you see that this, how the monetary structure as it exists in itself, how that ties in with the kind of the political struggle that we face and the ills of globalization. Obviously, it's kind of self-explanatory that obviously the economic system is central to how the world has been shaped as it is today. But what more can you say about that? How do you see this kind of question of how money, the money structure has been used to get us to where we are today?
It depends a little bit how far back you want to go in history, but I think Aristotle made a quite interesting point way back in time when he made a difference between economics, which he viewed as the science that would analyze management of resources, and chromatistics, which he viewed as the art of getting rich or the art of gaining economic power. And he viewed Aristotle, for example, interest, the practice of interest as a chromatistic practice because he thought it would centralize the economy and make the chromatists gain power in the long term. And today, the system we have today, it is really a chromatistic system on steroids.
Absolutely.
Because, and it's taken to the absolute full extreme because just as an example, a question I had quite early on when I thought about economics was why does almost every country on earth have a significant debt that is never paid back?
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out why, if everyone was indebted, why wouldn't they cancel out these debts with each other?
Who do they owe the money to? Other countries, right?
Yeah, and to some extent, of course, they might be indebted to each other to some extent, but not to the extent that we see today. And the reason we see these levels of debt is that they do not owe it to each other. They owe it to the big, large financial centers, the big banks of the world. And to quote former Swedish Prime Minister Göran Persson, I think he very wisely said one thing, and he when he said that one who is in debt is not free, and I think this cuts to the core of the current monetary structure because it makes nations, individuals, it makes us go further and further into debt, and making the super rich is not a term that is enough to describe these centers. It's a significant powerhouse that can be. Sometimes I describe it. I think it is rough to some extent, but I think there is truth to it that in the Soviet Union they had a communist party with many, many members. I mean, it was not one single person holding power there, the communist party, of course. And it's the same today. It's not one single small group or person, individuals that have the ultimate power. It is a large group with various influences and you might call it capitalist parties to some extent, but it's not the problem we face today is that it's not even recognized by most people. It's more operating behind the curtains. It's more efficient even if it's not maybe as violent as the Soviet Union. It is more efficient in the sense that it is more efficient in its propaganda because corporate media, even though people have lost to some extent faith in it, it is still efficient and many fall for the propaganda that is so intense and promote this general interest.
Yeah, it's like a little self-reinforcing bubble, right, of economies, the marketplace, big finance, and then you have tied into that, you have the advertisement agencies and the other big corporations tied to it, you have the political system, you have the media. It's like it's a conglomerate that is self-supporting and self-serving in the sense that they want to own and control everything too. And of course, as you say, in that bubble, you can have people walk in and out of that. You can have people being fired out of that bubble, if you will, or hung out to dry, stuff like that. But it is like a little blob entity that kind of is moving us in a direction which is now no longer dictated to by the interest of nations or by the interest of people inside of those nations. And that's a worrying element to me.
Just to emphasize for listeners that think about this topic is that this, we talk about a conglomerate. There was a really interesting study made in Switzerland in 2011 at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And the purpose of the study was to analyze the multinational corporations, all multinational corporations of the world, and see who owned them and who owns who. And the conclusion made there is quite interesting and really shows that in the core of the global economy, there are 18 or 19 banks at the time. It might have changed since that, but that own each other. So it is like a massive financial center that has influence. They don't control everything. It is not like every single thing in the world is controlled by this powerhouse, but it has enough power to guide the general direction of society as it is today.
Obviously, not every single move or direction is dictated to by these people, but they're enough of a force to influence the direction. And maybe, you know, when things do happen that's outside of their interest, they use it to their advantage or try to steer it back. And I know the study you're talking about, the network of global corporate control, we can add a link to it. Let me just read the abstract quickly because it's kind of interesting. It says, the structure of the control network of transnational corporations affects global market competition and financial stability. So far, only small national samples were studied, and there was no appropriate methodology to assess control globally. We present the first investigation of the architecture of the international ownership network along with a computation of the control held by each global player. We find that transnational corporations form a giant bow tie structure and that a large portion of control flows to a small, tight-knit core of financial institutions. This core can be seen as an economic, quote, super entity, unquote, that raises new important issues for both research and policy makers. So obviously they take a very kind of objective approach to this, is kind of very not strong in its language, but the fact is that they do list a couple of banks in the research and the study. But I know that there was a couple, like Deutsche Bank was in there, Lehman Brothers, which I can't even remember if they went under or not later, but
yeah, they did.
Do you know any of the other banks and financial institutions that are listed in the study?
I listed them also in the book, and they are accordingly Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, Barclays, Lehman Brothers, which went under. It is Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Prudential Financial, and a few others that are a bit less well-known. JP Morgan Chase, maybe I mentioned that already. But
yeah, some of the big banks that we have heard about, of course. So give us a little bit of a kind of an overview of how the modern economic system kind of how that came together. I mean, I don't know if there's specific events along the line that kind of stands out to you that maybe gives us a better understanding of both what money is, but kind of how it came together. Because in my view, I mean, I don't think we have to go back very far historically to understand the current modern monetary system. I know that we've had a long tradition, of course, from you know, goldsmiths and certain, you know, currencies and stuff in the Middle Ages, and it's been reformations and all that kind of stuff. But in my view, things begin to change when we have, for example, things as the creation of the Federal Reserve, the Bretton Woods Agreement, where we go off the gold standard, implementation of things like fractional reserve banking, even the Bank of International Settlements rises up in the early 1900s. But what stands out to you the most?
Well, besides the general practice of fractional reserve banking, and you can read more in the book if you want to learn what that really means. But what it means in practice is that banks are allowed to create credit for themselves out of nothing. And it was a practice from the goldsmiths, which many listeners already know, but that banks could create more notes than they had gold in their vaults. And the Federal Reserve, the implementation of the Federal Reserve Act is quite, I think, symbolically important. Even if this practice was not something new, it is quite spectacular in the sense that it structured this practice, and not only did it allow for this practice, but it also privatized the central bank itself in America, which is quite spectacular thing. And it is not hidden. Also, it is something that is just not emphasized, that it is also owned by these large corporations that we talked about earlier. So in that way, it is spectacular. But to quote the President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, let me find it here. He emphasized that this really was something new, and he went back to the fight that Andrew Jackson had, President of the United States, in the 1800s. And he said like this in a letter to Colonel Edward Mandelhaus, like this: "The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that the financial element in the larger centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson's. And I'm not wholly accepting the administration of Woodrow Wilson, which, you might add, signed the Federal Reserve Act. The country is going through a repetition of Jackson's fight with the Bank of the United States, only on a far bigger and broader basis." So, I mean, this is a fight that has been going on for a long time. And if you even want to be biblical, you can take the example of Jesus when he threw out the money changers of his time in the temple, the only, only time he was violent. So this isn't really something new in the sense it has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, control ultimately. It's other people trying to win over others or control others. And it's taken its shape in the financial system because it's been one of the more efficient ways of controlling commerce. I mean, economy-wise, the idea is sound. The idea of using a means of exchange instead of, you know, carrying the actual products back and forth and trading them, it's a sound idea. But it's been so misused, and it's been so many different reformations of it. And as you say, the Federal Reserve Act, that was in 1913. So it's not that long ago in the scope of human history that this has been implemented. So obviously, a little bit later, we're going to get into alternatives and what we can do and what other things that you're looking at that are kind of interesting. But is there anything else you want to say about what money is or how the modern kind of monetary system works before we leave that topic?
I think one interesting perspective of looking at all this is the name of the book is Money Power. And this is in several senses of the word, and one central perspective presented in this book, which you can read more about in chapter 1-4, is the view on money as a form of social energy or economic energy. And I would make it a lot more simple for myself if I would just say that I came up with this myself instead of referring to this very strange, peculiar document, Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, which allegedly was found by a Boeing employee in a copier in 1986. And this document presents some very interesting perspectives. For example, that economics really should be viewed as a science of energy. And what this means is quite literal in the sense that the money economics is compared to mechanics and electrics. And just to give the viewers a bit of a very brief introduction into this topic, you can think about electric current, for example. If you charge a battery, you have a power in the battery, and if you discharge the battery, you can perform work, you can do something about it. And it is argued here in the document that money should be viewed in the same way, as a potential economic energy that can be charged and discharged accordingly. It can be stored and used accordingly. And it's interesting to note in this context, the word itself, currency, that it really stems from current, from an energy flow. And another point made here, which talks about this, is that money itself or the economic system, it's not something evil. It can be designed in various ways. And they talk about in this particular document about the private utopia and the public utopia, in the sense that the private utopia is where a group of psychopathic slave owners have the ultimate control and enslave the people. Or it is also emphasized there that that money can be used as a for the public good, and not necessarily in the state in the meaning that the state needs to control the monetary system, but that it's used for helping a people on its way to the stars. In contrast to what's happening today. And I think this perspective rounds up also the same thing that already Aristotle mentioned with the difference between economics and chrematistics. So I really don't agree and don't like this perspective. For example, as mentioned before, with the Venus Project, that because the monetary system is corrupt, money in itself is evil. I think
right.
And I would like to end here by quoting Ayn Rand, which I think really sums it up. It is from Atlas Shrugged, where it's written like this. So you think money is the root of all evil. Have you ever asked yourselves what is the root of all money?
Yeah.
I think that cuts to the core, that it's not money that's the problem.
Yeah, we have to ask ourselves that question and to understand how it's controlled and for whose benefit. Because, you know, for a long time I was very much like, yeah, the free market, and it's great, it's going to take care of everything, and just let, you know, laissez-faire, just let it kind of roll and it will be good on its own. But I don't think like that anymore. I don't think that money is somehow smarter than people, or that we should be dictated to by currencies and by, you know, trends and ups and downs in the market. I think people should do that, and I think we should do things which are ultimately the best choices for the people. I don't have actually a problem with something being under control, as long as it's dictated to and controlled by people who have, you know, the best interest of people at heart. As you say, we could have been out exploring the stars right now, probably, but this is not what has happened. We've been controlled by bankers, and we've been controlled by foreign interests and globalists, internationalists, and everything else. And so we've been held back, basically. And at the same time, many people think, well, just, you know, let just the market take care of it. It will fix everything. But I'm not of that mind anymore. I don't know what you think.
I would add to that the market is neutral in the sense that it depends on the programming of the monetary structure. Like the money is really the blood of the economy. It is like the blood of the human body. It depends. If you have a bad flow, you can get sick. If you have a healthy flow, then it's not something. It's not the blood that is the problem. It's the way it flows. And the same goes for money. I think it's also goes in line with the perspective of money as a form of energy. Like energy is neither good or bad. It can be used for both. It depends on how it's utilized, simply.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. You know, and that's an interesting study too. Last point on this before we take a short break here in a little bit, but you mentioned this kind of occult aspect of the monetary system in a way, or how it was set up. I still don't know how I view this, if it's just simply people who are creating either the language or the concept of the monetary system at the time that knew these things. But it's pretty interesting when you go into, as you say, current of electricity, or even that it flows, right? There is a flow to the monetary system. And the fact that banks is something you have, like a river bank, for example, of controlling the current of the ocean or currency, right? So there is this whole kind of occult thing, if you will, on top of it. Even for a while, I remember I was talking about money is magic, of the concept of creating something out of nothing, because that's practically what they've done, right? They have they create money out of nothing these days. But with that money, they can actually create labor. They can create sweat equity. They can create something physical in the real world, a building, a swimming pool, whatever, food. So that's pretty interesting. But before we continue and talk more about this in the second segment, Zach, tell us how people can get a copy of the book. Let us know if you have a personal website, if there's a way that people can get in touch with you as well.
If you want to get in touch with me, the easiest way is to go to isaacbuhlmann.com. I have a... You can right there in on the website, you will see it. And the book you can get either in Arctos Bookshop or also on Amazon if you find that more simple. And for Swedish listeners, I can mention as well that I'm part of the editorial board of Nya Dagbladet, which is a rising alternative newspaper, I would say, in Sweden. I've written some text there as well, and plan to write in the future also. So for Swedish listeners, go and check that out as well. And if somebody is interested in learning more hands-on on this topic, just get in touch. I like to teach this topic. It needs to be spread out more and more. So just get in touch if you have some event or interesting thing that you want to organize.
Great. We'll have links on the site. Again, the title of the book is Money Power, A Force for Freedom or for Slavery. We'll talk more with Isaac in the second segment, so stay tuned. We're going to continue and ask him a bit more about not only the monetary system, but also about alternative currencies, how things actually are structured these days in terms of how political ideologies have lined up with the economic system and stuff like that. So it'd be really interesting as we continue. RedIceMembers.com is the website where you can check out the second hour. Head on over there, get a subscription, and we'll see you on the other side. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.